Chapter 8. I joined Wolf in the dining room at 7:15 as usual, and sat at table. But I didn't really dine, because I had an 8:30 date down in the village and had to rush it some. Par for Wolf, from clams to cheese, is an hour and a half. Dating Delia Brandt hadn't been any strain on my talents. I had got her on the phone at the first try, given her my own name and occupation, and told her I had been asked by a client to see her and find out if she could supply enough material on Michael M. Malloy, her late employer, for a magazine article under her byline, to be ghosted by the client. The proceeds would be split. After a few questions, she said she would be willing to consider it and would be at home to me at 8:30. So I hurried a little with the roast duckling and left Wolf alone with the salad. It wouldn't have hurt the house at 43 Arbor Street any to get the same treatment as the one at 171 East 52nd. The outside could have used some paint, and a do-it-yourself elevator would have been a big improvement on the narrow, dingy wooden stairs. Three flights up, she was not waiting on the threshold to greet me, and, finding no button to push, I tapped on the door. From the time it took her, you might have thought she had to traverse a spacious reception hall. But when the door opened, the room was right there. I spoke. "My name's Goodwin," I phoned.
"Oh," she said, "of course. I had forgotten. Come in."
It was one of those rooms that call for expert dodging to get anywhere. God knows why the piano bench was smack in the main traffic lane, and he also knows why there was a piano bench at all, since there was no piano. Anyway, it was handy for my hat and coat. She crossed to a couch and invited me to sit, and since there was no chair nearby, I perched on the couch too, twisting around to face her.
"I really had forgotten," she said apologetically. "My mind must have been soaring around."
She waved a hand to show how a mind soars. She was young, well-shaped and well-kept, well-dressed and well-shod, with a soft, clear skin and bright brown eyes, and well-cut fine brown hair, but a mind that soared.
"Didn't you say you were a detective?" she asked. "Something about a magazine?"
"That's right," I told her. "This editor thinks he'd like to try a new slant on a murder. There have been thousands of pieces about murderers. He thinks he might use one called The Last Month of a Murdered Man, or The Last Year of a Murdered Man, by his secretary."
"Oh, not my name?"
"Well, sure, your name, too. And now that I've seen you, a good big picture of you. I wouldn't mind having one myself."
"Now, don't get personal."
It was hard to believe the contrast between what my eyes saw and my ears heard. Any man would have been glad to walk down a theater aisle with her, but there would have to be an understanding that she would keep her mouth shut.
"I'll try not to," I assured her. "I can always turn my back."
"The idea is this. You'll tell me things about Mr. Malloy, what he said and did and how he acted, and I'll report to the editor, and if he thinks there's an article in it, he'll come and talk with you. How's that?"
"Well, it couldn't be called The Last Year of a Murdered Man. It would have to be called The Last 10 months of a Murdered Man, because I only worked for him 10 months.
"Okay, that's even better. Now, I understand.
How many days are there in 10 months?
"It depends on the months. Roughly 300.
"We could call it The Last 300 days of a Murdered Man."
"A good idea. I understand that occasionally you had dinner with Malloy at a restaurant. Was it..."
"Who told you that?"
I had three choices: get up and go, strangle her, or sit on her. "Look, Miss Brandt, I'm being paid by the hour, and I've got to earn it. Was it to discuss business matters, or was it social?" She smiled, which made her even prettier.
"Oh, that was just social. He never talked about business to me. It had got so he didn't want to have dinner with his wife, and he hated to eat alone. I'd love to put that in. I know some people think I allowed him liberties, but I never did."
"Did he try to take liberties?"
"Oh, of course. Married men always do. That's because with their wives it's not a liberty anymore."
"Yeah, that's why I never married.
Did he... Oh, aren't you married? But you've had enough of her. So had I, but I was on duty, and I stuck with it for 3 solid hours. I had to go through another ordeal about halfway through. We were thirsty, and she went to the kitchenette for liquid, and came back with a bottle of ginger ale, a bottle of gin, and 2 glasses with 1 cube of ice in each. I apologized, said I had ulcers, and asked for milk. She said she didn't have any, and I asked for water. I will go beyond the call of duty in a pinch, but I wouldn't drink gin and ginger ale to get the lowdown on Lizzie Borden. It was bad enough to sit there and watch her sipping away at it. In the taxi on my way downtown to keep the date, I had felt some slight compunction at imposing on a poor working girl with a phony approach. In the taxi on my way home, having told her I would let her know if the editor still liked the idea, my conscience was sound asleep. If a conscience could snore, it probably would have. Wolfe, who rarely turns in before midnight, was at his desk reading A Secret Understanding by Merle Miller. He didn't look up when I entered, so I went to the safe for the expense book and entered the amounts I had given the hired help for expenses, $100 for each, put the book back and closed the safe and locked it, and cleared up my desk. I refused to meet a cluttered desk in the morning. Then I stood up and looked down at him. "Excuse me, anything from Fred or Johnny that needs attention?" He finished a paragraph and looked up. "No. Fred called at 11 and reported no progress. Johnny didn't call." "Shall I save mine for morning?"
"No, that woman will be here. Did you get anything?"
"I don't know." I sat. "She's either a feather brain or a damn good imitation. She starts every other sentence with, 'Oh!' You'd walk out on her in 3 minutes. She drinks 4 parts ginger ale and 1 part gin."
"No."
"Yes."
"Good heavens. Did you?"
"No, but I had to watch her. 2 items. One day last October, a button on his coat was loose, and she offered to sew it on for him. While she was doing so, some papers fell out of the pocket, and when she picked them up, she glanced at them. So she says, papers can fall out of pockets or they can be taken out. Anyhow, she was looking at one of the papers, which was a list of names and figures, when he suddenly entered from his room, snatched the paper from her, and gave her hell. He slapped her, but that's off the record because she doesn't want it to be in the article. And besides, he apologized and bought her champagne at dinner that evening. She says he was so mad he turned white."
"And the names and figures?"
"I hoped you would ask that. She can't remember. She thinks the figures were amounts of money, but she's not sure."
"Hardly a bonanza."
"No, sir. Neither is the other item, but it's more recent. One day between Christmas and New Year's, he asked her how she would like to take a trip to South America with him. He had to go on business and would need a secretary. I should mention that he had been trying to take liberties and she hadn't allowed it. She liked the idea of a trip to South America, but knowing that what her liberties up here are just a matter of course down there, she told him she'd think it over. He said there wouldn't be much time for thinking it over because the business matters wouldn't wait. He also said they were confidential matters and made her promise she wouldn't mention the proposed trip to anyone. She put him off and hadn't said yes or no by January 3rd, the day he died. So she says, I think she said yes. She is not a good liar. I didn't mention that her mind soars."
"Soars where?"
I waved a hand. "Just soars. You would enjoy her."
"No doubt."
He looked up at the clock. Past midnight.
"Has she a job?"
"Oh, yes, with an import firm downtown. Apparently no connection."
"Very well."
He pushed his chair back, yawned, and got up.
"Johnny should have reported. Confound him, he's too set on a master stroke."
"Instructions for morning?"
"No, I'll need you here for developments, if any. Good night."
He went to the elevator, and I went to the stairs.
Up in my room, undressing, I decided to dream of Selma Malloy, something like her being trapped in a blazing building at an upper window, afraid to jump for the fireman's net. I would march up, wave the fireman aside, stretch my arms, and down she would come, light as a feather, into my embrace. The light as a feather part was important, since otherwise there might have been some bones broken. I didn't consider this reneging on my decision, because you can't hold a man responsible for his dreams. But I didn't follow through on it. No dreams at all. In the morning I didn't even remember that I had been going to dream, but I never do remember anything in the morning until I have washed and showered and shaved and dressed and made my way down to the kitchen. With the orange juice the fog begins to lift, and with the coffee it's all clear. It's a good thing Wolf breakfasts in his room, on a tray taken up by Fritz, and then goes up to the plant rooms. If we met before breakfast, he would have fired me, or I would have quit long ago. Thursday started busy and kept it up. There were three letters from PH's, answers to the ad, in the morning mail, and I had to answer them. There was a phone call from Omaha from James R. Harold. His wife was impatient. I told him we had five men working on the case, including Saul Panzer and me, and we would report as soon as there was anything worth reporting. Fred Durkin came in person to confer. He had visited five establishments with phone booths within two blocks of the 52nd Street house and had found no one who remembered anything about any user of the phone around 9 o'clock on January 3rd. The soda jerk, who had been on duty at the drugstore that evening, had left and gone somewhere in Jersey. Should Fred find him? I told him yes and wished him luck. Ori Cather phoned from Fryer's office to ask if we had arranged with Mrs. Malloy to hire a lawyer to establish her position legally, and I told him no, that would be done when she came to see Wolf. Lon Cohen of the Gazette phoned and said he had a riddle for me. It goes like this, he said. Archie Goodwin tells me on Tuesday that he and Nero Wolf aren't interested in the Hayes murder trial. The PH in Wolf's ad is a different person, no connection. But Wednesday evening I get a note from Goodwin asking me to give the bearer, Saul Panzer, a good clear print of a picture of Michael M. Malloy. Here's the riddle. What's the difference between Archie Goodwin and a double-breasted liar? I couldn't blame him, but neither could I straighten him out. I told him the note Saul had brought him must have been a forgery, and promised to give him a front-page spread as soon as we had one. Selma Malloy came on the dot at 11. I let her in and took her coat, a quiet gray plaid, in the hall, and was putting it on a hanger when the elevator bumped to a stop and Wolf emerged. He stopped, facing her, inclined his head nearly an inch when I pronounced her name, turned, and made for the office. And I convoyed her in and to the red leather chair. He sat and leveled his eyes at her, trying not to scowl. He hates to work, and this would probably be not only an all-day session, but all day with a woman. Then he had an idea. His head turned, and he spoke. "Archie, since I'm a stranger to Mrs. Malloy and you are not, it might be better for you to tell her about the legal situation regarding her husband's estate." She looked at me. In her apartment she had sat with her back to a window, and here she was facing me, but the stronger light gave me no reason to lower my guard. She squinted at me. "His estate? I thought you wanted to go on from yesterday." "We do," I assured her. "By the way, I told you I wouldn't be here, but my program was changed. The estate thing is a part of the investigation. We want access to Malloy's records and papers, and since no will has been found, the widow has a right to them, and you're the widow. Of course you can let us look at anything that's in the apartment, but there should be some legal steps. For instance, you should be named as administrator."
"But I don't want to be administrator. I don't want anything to do with his estate. I might have wanted some of the furniture if..."
She let it hang. She shook her head.
"I don't want anything."
"What about cash for your current expenses?"
"I wondered about that yesterday after you had gone.
Her eyes were meeting mine straight.
Whether Nero Wolfe was expecting me to pay him?
He isn't. I looked at Wolfe, and his head moved left, just perceptibly, and back. So we were still keeping our client under our hat. I met her eyes again. Our interest in the case developed through a conversation with Mr. Fryer, and all we expect from you is information. I asked about cash only because there must be some in your husband's estate.
If there is, I don't want it. I have some savings of my own, enough to go along on a while. I just don't know what I'm going to do.
She pinned her lower lip with her teeth and after a moment released it.
I don't know what I'm going to do, but I don't want to be his administrator or have anything to do with it. I should have left him long ago, but I had married him with my eyes open and my silly pride.
Okay, but it might help if we could take a look at his papers. For instance, his checkbook. Miss Brandt tells me that the furniture in the office was sold and that before it was taken away, some man went through the desks and removed the contents. Do you know about that?
Yes, that was a friend of mine. And he had been a friend of my husband's, Tom Irwin. He said the office should be closed up, and I asked him to attend to it.
What happened to the stuff he took?
He brought it to the apartment. It's there now in three cartons. I've never looked at it.
I would like to. You'll be here with Mr. Wolfe for quite a while. I could go up to the apartment and do it now if you're willing to let me have the key. Without the slightest hesitation, she said, "Of course," and opened her handbag. It didn't put her down a notch in my book, her being so trustful with a comparative stranger. All it meant was that with her PH convicted of murder, she didn't give a damn about anything at all, and besides, I was the comparative stranger. Glancing at Wolfe and getting a nod, I went to her and took the keys. Told her I would let her know if I found anything helpful and would give her a receipt for anything I brought away, and headed for the hall. I had just taken my top coat from the rack when the doorbell rang, and a look through the one-way glass showed me Saul Panzer out on the stoop. Putting the coat back, I opened up. There are things about Saul I don't understand and never will. For instance, the old cap he always wears. If I wore that cap while tailing a subject, I'd be spotted in the first block. If I wore it while calling on people for information, they would suspect I was cuckoo or quaint and draw the curtains. But Saul never gets spotted unless he wants to, and for extracting material from people's insides, nothing can equal him except a stomach pump. While he was hanging up his coat and sticking the cap in its pocket, I stepped to the office door to tell Wolfe, and Wolfe said to bring him in. He came, and I followed him.
"Yes?" Wolfe inquired.
Saul, standing, shot a glance at the red leather chair and said, "A report."
"Go ahead. Mrs. Malloy's interest runs with ours. Mrs. Malloy, this is Mr. Panzer."
She asked him how he did, and he bowed. That's another thing about him, his bow. It's as bad as his cap. He sat down on the nearest yellow chair, knowing that Wolfe wants people at eye level, and reported. Two employees of the Metropolitan Safe Deposit Company identified a picture of Michael M. Malloy. They say it's a picture of Richard Randall, a renter of a box there. I didn't tell them it was Malloy, but I think one of them suspects it. I didn't try to find out what size the box is or when he first rented it or any other details because I thought I'd better get instructions. If they get stirred up enough to look into it and decide that one of their boxes was probably rented under another name by a man who has been murdered, they'll notify the district attorney. I don't know the law. I don't know what rights the DA has after he has got a conviction, since he couldn't be looking for evidence, but I thought you might want to get to the box first.
I do, Wolfe declared. How good is the identification?
I'd bank on it. I'm satisfied. Do you want to know just how it went?
No, not if you're satisfied. How much are they already stirred up?
I think not much. I was pretty careful. I doubt if either of them will go upstairs with it, but they might, and I thought you might want to move.
I do. Wolfe turned. Mrs. Malloy, do you know what this is about?
Yes, I think so.
She looked at me.
Isn't it what I told you yesterday, the envelope and slip of paper when I was looking for the hockey ticket?
That's it, I told her.
And you found out already that my husband was Richard Randall?
We have, Wolf said. And that changes the situation. We must find out what is in that box as soon as possible, and to do so we must first demonstrate that Randall was Malloy, and second, establish your right to access. Since in handling his safe deposit box a man certainly makes fingerprints, the first presents no technical problem, but it must wait upon the second. When you said, madam, that you would have nothing to do with your husband's estate, I understood and respected your attitude. Rationally, it could not be defended, but emotionally it was formidable. And when feeling takes over, sense is impotent. Now it's different. We must see the contents of that box, and we can get to it only through you. You will have to assert your rights as the widow and take control of the estate. The law can crawl, and usually does, but in an emergency it can. What are you shaking your head for?
I've told you I won't do that.
Hearing her tone and seeing her eyes and her jaw, he started to glare but decided it wouldn't work. So he turned to me. Archie? I did the glaring at him, and then toned the glare down as I transferred it to her. Mrs. Malloy, I said, Mr. Wolfe is a genius, but geniuses have their weak spots. And one of his is that he pretends to believe that attractive young women can refuse me nothing. It comes in handy when an attractive young woman says no to something he wants because it's an excuse for passing the buck to me, which he just did. I don't know what to do with it, and he can't expect me to. He just said himself that when feeling takes over, sense is impotent, so what good will it do to try to reason with you? But may I ask you a question? She said yes. Suppose no good grounds for a retrial or an appeal are found, and the sentence is carried out, and Peter Hayes dies in the electric chair. And sometime later, when a court gets around to it, that safe deposit box is opened, and it contains something that starts an investigation and leads to evidence that someone else committed the murder. What would your feeling be then? She had her lip pinned again and had to release it to say,
I don't think that's a fair question.
Why not? All I did was suppose, and it wasn't inconceivable. That box may be empty, but it could contain what I said. I think the trouble is that you don't believe there is any evidence, in that safe deposit box or anywhere else, that will clear Peter Hayes because he's guilty. So why should you do something you don't want to do?
That's not true. It's not true.
You know damn well it's true. Her head went down, forward, and her hands came up to cover her face. Wolf glowered at me. From that room he has walked out on a lot of different people, but when a woman goes to pieces he doesn't walk out, he runs. I shook my head at him. I didn't think Selma Malloy was going to slip the bit. She didn't. When she finally raised her head, her eyes met mine, and she said calmly,
Listen, Mr. Goodwin. Didn't I help all I could yesterday, and didn't I come today? You know I did. But how can I claim any rights as Mike Malloy's widow when for 2 years I bitterly regretted I was his wife? Don't you see it's impossible? Isn't there some other way? Can't I ask for someone else to be administrator and he can have rights?
I don't know, I told her. That's a legal question. Get Mr. Parker, Wolf snapped. I turned and pulled the phone to me and dialed. Since Nathaniel Parker had answered some 10,000 legal questions for us over the years, I didn't have to look up the number. While I was getting him, Saul Panzer asked Wolf if he should leave and was told to wait until there was some place for him to leave for. When I had Parker, Wolf took his phone. I had to admire his performance. He would have liked to tell Parker that we were being obstructed by a perverse and capricious female. But with her sitting there, that would have been inadvisable. So he merely said that for reasons of her own, the widow refused to assert her claims, and put the legal problem. From there on, his part was mostly grunts. When he hung up, he turned to the female.
Mr. Parker says it's complicated, and since it's urgent, he wants to ask you some questions. He will be here in 20 minutes. He says it will expedite matters if you will decide whom you would like to suggest as administrator. Have you anyone in mind?
Why, no.
She frowned. She looked at me and back at him.
Could it be Mr. Goodwin?
My dear madam, Wolfe was exasperated. Use your faculties. You met Mr. Goodwin yesterday for the first time in his capacity as a private investigator. It would be highly inappropriate, and the court would find it so. It should be someone you know well and trust. What about the man who closed the office and took the cartons to your apartment, Thomas Irwin?
I don't think... She considered it. I don't think I'd want to ask him to do this. His wife wouldn't like it. But I wouldn't mind asking Pat Deegan. He might say no, but I could ask him.
Who is he?
Patrick A. Deegan. He's the head of the Mechanics Alliance Welfare Association. His office isn't far from here on 39th Street. I could call him now.
How long have you known him?
3 years since I was married. He was a friend of my husband's, but he always... I mean, he really is my friend. I'm sure he is. Shall I call him? What will I say?
Tell him you wish to request a favor of him and ask him to come here. Now, if possible. If he asks questions, tell him you would rather not discuss it on the phone. And I venture a suggestion in case he comes and consents to act. Legal services will be required, and he may want to name the lawyer to be engaged to perform them. I urge you not to agree. From a legal standpoint, it will be your interests the lawyer will represent, whether you wish to renounce them or not, and it will be proper and desirable for you to choose him.
Why can't I choose the lawyer he names?
Because I wouldn't trust him. Because I suspect Mr. Deegan of having killed your husband.
She goggled at him.
You suspect Pat Deegan? You never heard of him until just now.
Wolfe nodded.
I made it sensational. Purposely. I suspect each and all of your husband's associates, as I must until I have reason to discriminate, and Mr. Deegan is one of them. I advise you not to let him name the lawyer. If you are at a loss to choose one, I suggest Nathaniel Parker, who will be here shortly. I have dealt with him many years, and I recommend him without reservation. As for trusting me, either you believe that I am earnestly seeking an end you desire, or it is folly for you to be here at all. It was a good pitch, but it didn't do the job, not completely. She looked at me, looking the question instead of asking it. I gave her a strictly professional smile.
Parker is as good as they come, Mrs. Malloy.
All right, then. She arose. May I use the phone?
Chapter 9. Since Patrick A. Deegan was the first suspect we had laid eyes on, unless you want to count Albert Fryer or Delia Brandt, naturally, I gave him some attention. And I had plenty of opportunity during the hour that the conference lasted. In appearance, I wouldn't have called him sinister. A medium-sized specimen in his early 40s with a fair start on a paunch, round face, wide nose, and dark brown eyes that moved quickly and often. He greeted Selma Malloy as a friend, taking her hand in both of his, but not as one who had been bewitched by her into shooting her husband and framing her PH for it. I had him mostly in profile during the conference, since he was on a yellow chair facing Wolfe, with Nathaniel Parker on another one between Deegan and me. After making the phone call, Mrs. Malloy had returned to the red leather chair. Saul Panzer had retired to one in the rear, over by the bookshelves. When the situation had been explained to Deegan by Mrs. Malloy, and she had asked the favor, he wasted 5 minutes trying to get her to change her mind. When he saw that was no go, he said he would be willing to do what she wanted, provided it was legally feasible. and on that point he would have to consult his lawyer. She said, of course, he would want to ask his lawyer about it, but her lawyer, Mr. Parker, was right there and would explain how it could be done. Not bad for a girl who wasn't using her faculties. Deegan turned his quick brown eyes on Parker, polite but not enthusiastic. Parker cleared his throat and started in. That was the first he had heard that he was Mrs. Malloy's counsel, since he had had only a minute or two with us before Deegan arrived, but he didn't raise the point. From there on it got highly technical, and I had a notion, rejected as unprofessional, to give Mrs. Malloy's faculties a recess by taking her up to the plant rooms and showing her the orchids. Anyone sufficiently interested can call Parker at his office, Phoenix 52382, and get the details. What it boiled down to was that there were three different ways of handling it, but one would be much too slow, and which of the other two was preferable. Deegan made two phone calls to his lawyer, and finally they got it settled. Parker would start the ball rolling immediately, and Deegan agreed to be available for an appearance before a judge on short notice. Parker thought we might get a look at the inside of the safe deposit box by Monday, and possibly sooner. He was just getting up to go when the phone rang and I answered it. It was Sergeant Pearly Stebbins of Homicide West. He told me some news, and I asked a few questions, and when he asked me a question, I decided I didn't know the answer and asked him to hold the wire. Covering the transmitter, I turned to Wolfe. Stebbins. At 11:48 last night, a man was hit by a car on Riverside Drive in the 90s and killed. The body has been identified as that of John Joseph Keams. About an hour ago, the car that hit him was found parked on Upper Broadway, and it's hot. It was stolen last night from where it was parked on 92nd Street. The fact that it was a stolen car makes Pearly think it may have been premeditated murder, possibly in connection with a case Keams was working on. And knowing that Johnny Keams often does jobs for you, he asks if he was working for you last night. I told him you sometimes hire an operative without telling me, and I'd ask you. I'm asking you.
Tell him I'm engaged and you'll call him back.
I did so, hung up and swiveled. Wolf's lips were tight. His eyes were half closed and his temple was twitching. He met my eyes and demanded,
"You knew him. How much chance is there that he would have let a car kill him by inadvertence?"
"Practically none, not Johnny Keams." Wolf's head turned.
"So?"
"No, sir."
Solid got to his feet while I was reporting to Wolf.
"Of course it could happen, but I agree with Archie."
Wolf's head turned more to the left. "Mrs. Malloy, if Mr. Goodwin was correct when he said that you believe there can be no evidence that will clear Peter Hayes, this bitter pill for me is not so bitter for you. Not only can there be such evidence, there will be. Johnny Keams was working for me last night on this case, and he was murdered. That settles it. You have been told that I thought it likely that Peter Hayes is innocent. Now I know he is."
His head jerked right.
"Mr. Parker, the urgency is now pressing. I beg you to move with all possible speed. Well?"
I wouldn't say that Parker moved with all possible speed, but he moved. He made for the hall and was gone. Deegan, lifted from his chair by Wolf's tone and manner, had a question.
"Do you realize what you're saying?"
"Yes, sir, I do."
"Why, do you challenge it?"
"Well, no, I don't challenge it, but you're worked up, and I wondered if you realized that you were practically promising Mrs. Malloy that Peter Hayes will be cleared. What if you're giving her false hopes? What if you can't make good on it? I think I have the right to ask as an old friend of hers."
"Perhaps you have." Wolf nodded at him. "I concede it. It's a stratagem, Mr. Deegan, directed at myself. By committing myself to Mrs. Malloy before witnesses, I add to other incentives that of preserving my self-conceit. If the risk of failure is grave for her, it is also grave for me.
You didn't have to make it so damned positive.
Deegan went to Mrs. Malloy and put a hand on her shoulder. I hope to God he's right, Selma. It's certainly rough on you. Anything more I can do? She said no and thanked him, and I went to the hall to let him out. Back in the office, Saul had moved back to a seat up front, presumably by invitation, and Wolfe was lecturing Mrs. Malloy. And I'll answer your question, but only on condition that henceforth you confide in no one. You are to tell no one anything you may learn of my surmises or plans. If I suspected Mr. Deegan, as I did and do, I now have better reason to suspect other friends of yours. Do you accept the condition?
I'll accept anything that will help, she declared. All I asked was what he was doing, the man that was killed.
And I want to tell you, because you may be of help, but first I must be assured that you will trust no one. You will repeat nothing and reveal nothing.
All right, I promise.
Regarding her, he rubbed the end of his nose with a fingertip. It was a dilemma that had confronted him many times over the years. There were very few men whose tongues he had ever been willing to rely on, and no women at all. But she might have facts he needed, and he had to risk it. So he did.
Mr. Keams left here shortly after 7 o'clock last evening with specific instructions to see the three people who were with you at the theater the evening of January 3rd. He was to learn... What's the matter?
Her chin had jerked up and her lips had parted.
You might have told me that you suspect me, too. I suppose you did when you said you suspect all of my husband's associates.
Nonsense. His target was not your alibi. He was to learn all the circumstances of the invitation you got to use an extra theater ticket. That was what got you away from your apartment for the evening. Whoever went there to kill your husband certainly knew you were safely out of the way. And not only that, he may have arranged for your absence. That was what Mr. Keams was after. He had the names and addresses of Mr. Irwin and Mr. and Mrs. Arkoff, and he was to report to me at once if he got any hint that the invitation to you was designed. He didn't report, but he must have got a hint, or someone thought he did, and it must have been a betraying hint, since, to suppress it, someone stole an automobile and killed him with it. That is not palpable, but it's highly probable, and it's my assumption until it's discredited.
But then, she shook her head, I just don't believe. Did he see them? Who did he see?
I don't know. As I say, he didn't report. We'll find out. I want all you can tell me about that invitation. It came from Mrs. Arkoff.
Yes, she phoned me.
When?
At 7:30. I told all about it at the trial.
I know you did, but I want it firsthand. What did she say?
She said that she and Jerry, her husband, had asked Tom and Fanny Irwin to dinner and a show. And she and Jerry were at the restaurant, and Tom had just phoned that Fanny had a headache and couldn't come, and he would meet them in the theater lobby. And Rita, that's Mrs. Arkoff, she asked me to come, and I said I would.
Did you go to the restaurant?
No, there wasn't time, and I had to dress. I met them at the theater.
At what time?
8:30.
They were there?
Rita and Jerry were. We waited a few minutes for Tom, and then Rita and I went on in, and Jerry waited in the lobby for Tom. Rita told him to leave the ticket at the box office, but he said no. He had told him they'd meet him in the lobby. Rita and I went on in because we didn't want to miss the curtain. It was Julie Harris in the Lark.
How soon did the men join you?
It was quite a while, almost the end of the first act.
When does the first act end?
I don't know. It's rather long.
Wolfe's head moved.
You've seen that play, Archie?
Yes, sir. I would say a quarter to ten, maybe 22.
Have you seen it, Saul?
Yes, sir, 20 to 10.
You know that?
Yes, sir, just my habit of noticing things.
Don't disparage it. The more you put in a brain, the more it will hold, if you have one. How long would it take to get from 171 East 52nd Street to that theater?
After 9 o'clock?
Yes. With luck, if you were in a hurry, 8 minutes. That would be a minimum.
From that up to 15.
Wolf turned. Mrs. Malloy, I wonder that you haven't considered the possible significance of this. The anonymous call to the police saying that a shot had been heard was at 9:18. The police arrived at 9:23. Even if he waited to see them arrive, and he probably didn't, he could have reached the theater before the first act ended. Didn't that occur to you?
She was squinting at him.
If I understand you, you mean didn't it occur to me that Jerry or Tom might have killed Mike?
Obviously, didn't it?
No.
She made it a little louder than it had to be, and I hoped Wolf understood that she was raising her voice not at him but at herself. It hadn't occurred to her because the minute she had learned on getting home that January night that her husband had been found with a bullet in his head and that P.H., with a gun in his pocket, had tried to force his way out, she thought she knew what had happened, and it had settled in her like a lump of lead. But she wasn't going to tell Wolf that. She told him instead,
"There was no reason for Jerry to kill him, or Tom. Why? And they had been in the bar across the street. Tom came not long after Rita and I went in, and said he needed a drink, and they went and had one."
"Which one of them told you that?"
"Both of them. They told Rita and me, and we said they must have had more than one."
Wolf grunted.
"Go back a little. Wouldn't it have been the natural thing for Mr. Arkoff to leave the ticket at the box office instead of waiting in the lobby?"
"Not the way it was. Rita didn't ask him to leave it at the box office. She told him to. And he doesn't like to have her tell him to do things. So she does."
She came forward in the chair.
"Listen, Mr. Wolf," she said earnestly. "If that man getting killed, if that means what you think it does, I don't care what happens to anybody. I haven't been caring what happened to me. I've just been feeling I might as well be dead, and I'm certainly not going to start worrying about other people, not even my best friends. But I think this is no use. Even if they lied about being in the bar, neither of them had any reason."
"We'll see about that," he told her. "Someone had reason to fear Johnny Keams enough to kill him."
He glanced up at the clock.
"Luncheon will be ready in 7 minutes. You'll join us? You too, Saul. Afterward, you'll stay here to be on hand if Mr. Parker needs you. And, Mrs. Malloy, you will stay too and tell me everything you know about your friends, and you'll invite them to join us here at 6 o'clock.
"But I can't," she protested. "How can I? Now?"
"You said you weren't going to worry about them. Yesterday morning, Peter Hayes, talking with Mr. Goodwin, used the same words you have just used. He said he might as well be dead. I intend that both of you..."
"Oh," she cried to me. "You saw him? What did he say?"
"I was only with him a few minutes," I told her. "Except that he might as well be dead, not much. He can tell you himself when we finish this job."
I went to Wolf. "I've got to call Pearlie. What do I tell him?" He pinched his nose. He has an idea that pinching his nose makes his sense of smell keener, and a faint aroma of cheese dumplings was coming to us from the kitchen.
"Tell him that Mr. Keams was working for me last evening, investigating a confidential matter. But I don't know whom he had seen just prior to his death. And that we'll inform him if and when we get information that might be useful. I want to speak with those people before he does."
As I turned to dial, Fritz entered to announce lunch.
Chapter 10
Not long ago I got a letter from a woman who had read some of my accounts of Nero Wolfe's activities, asking me why I was down on marriage. She said she was 23 years old and was thinking of having a go at it herself. I wrote her that as far as I knew there was absolutely nothing wrong with marriage. The trouble was the way people handled it, and I gave her a couple of examples. The examples I used were Mr. and Mrs. Jerome Markoff and Mr. and Mrs. Thomas L. Irwin, though I didn't mention their names, and I had got my material from what I saw and heard in the first 5 minutes after they arrived at Wolfe's place that Thursday at 6 o'clock. They all arrived together, and there was a little bustle in the hall, getting their things off and disposed of. That was finished, and I was ready to herd them down the hall and into the office, when Rita Arkoff touched her husband's elbow, pointed to a chair against the wall, and told him, "Your hat, Jerry, hang it up." No wonder he hadn't left the ticket at the box office. Before he could react normally, like making a face at her or telling her to go to hell, I got the hat myself and put it on the rack, and we proceeded to the office, where the Irwins immediately contributed their share. I had the chairs spaced comfortably to give everyone elbow room, but Tom Irwin pushed his close to his wife's, sat, and took her hand in his and held on to it. I am not by any means against holding hands in wedded bliss or unwedded, but only if both hands want to, and Fanny Irwin's didn't. She didn't actually try to pull it away, but she sure would have liked to. I hope the examples I gave her will keep my 23-year-old correspondent from developing into an order-giver or a one-way handholder. But leave it to her. She'll find some kind of monkey wrench to toss into the machinery, and if she doesn't, her husband will. However, I'm getting ahead of myself. Before 6 o'clock came and brought the two couples, there were other happenings. My lunch was interrupted twice. Fred Durkin phoned to say that he had seen the soda jerk who had moved to Jersey and got nothing, and had worn out his welcome at all places with phone booths within 2 blocks of 171 East 52nd Street. I told him to come in. Ari Cather phoned to ask if we had an administrator yet, and I told him also to come in. They arrived before we finished lunch, and back in the office, Wolfe told them about Johnny Keams. They agreed with Saul and me that the odds were big that the car that had hit enough of him to kill him had been not careless but careful. They hadn't had much love for him, but they had worked a lot with him. As Fred Durkin said, "Lots of worse guys are still walking around." Ori Cather said yes, and one of them has got something coming. No one mentioned that until he got it. They had better keep an eye out when crossing a street, but they were all thinking it. They were given errands. Saul was to go to Parker's office to be at hand. Ori, armed with Selma Malloy's keys, was to go to her apartment and inspect the contents of the 3 cartons. Fred, supplied by Mrs. Malloy with descriptions of Jerome Arkoff and Tom Irwin, was to go to the Longacre Theater and the bar across the street and see if he could find someone who could remember as far back as January 3rd. Fred was getting the scraps. When they had gone, Wolfe tackled Mrs. Malloy again to get the lowdown on her friends. Using the phone in the kitchen while he was busy with the staff, she had asked them to come to Wolfe's office at 6 o'clock. I don't know what she had told them, since she couldn't very well say that Wolfe wanted to find out which one of them had killed Mike Malloy, but anyhow they had said they would come. I had suggested that she could tell them that Wolfe was working with Fryer and was trying to find some grounds for an appeal, and probably she did. Of course, Wolfe had her cornered. If there was any chance of springing her PH, she was all for it. But friends are friends, for people who are entitled to have any, until shown to be otherwise. If you want to take the word of one bewitched, she handled it very nicely. She stuck strictly to facts. For instance,
She did not say that Fanny Irwin and Pat Deegan were snatching a snuggle. She merely said that Rita Arkoff thought they were. Jerome Arkoff, 38, a husky six-footer with a long, solemn face, gray-blue eyes, a long nose and big ears, according to the description she had given Fred Durkin, was a television producer, successful enough to have ulcers. She had met him through Rita, who had been a model when Selma was, and who had married Arkoff about the time Selma had quit modeling and gone to work for Malloy. Arkoff and Malloy had met through their wives' friendship, and there had been nothing special in their relations, either of harmony or of hostility. If there had been anything between them that could possibly have led to murder, Selma knew nothing of it. She conceded it was conceivable that Malloy and Rita had put horns on Arkoff without her ever suspecting it, and Arkoff had removed the blot by blotting out Malloy. But not that he had also framed Peter Hayes. Arkoff had liked Peter Hayes. Thomas L. Irwin, 40, was slender, handsome, and dark-skinned, with a skimpy black mustache. He was an executive in a big printing company in charge of sales. Selma had met him shortly after her marriage, about the same time she had met Patrick Deegan. His company did printing for Deegan's organization, the Mechanics Alliance Welfare Association, MAWA for short. Fanny Irwin called Deegan Mawa. Irwin and Malloy had got on each other's nerves and had had some fairly hot exchanges, but Selma had never seen any indication of serious enmity. It was a thin crop. Wolf poked all around, but the only real dirt he found was Rita Arkoff's suspicion about Fanny Irwin and Pat Deegan. And that wasn't very promising. Even if it was true, and even if Irwin had been aware of it or suspected it, he could hardly have expected to relieve his feelings by killing Malloy. Wolf abandoned it as fruitless and had gone back to the relationships among the men when a phone call came from Saul Panzer, from Parker's office. Some papers were ready for Mrs. Malloy to sign before a notary, and would she please come at once? She left, and 5 minutes later it was 4 o'clock, and Wolf went up to the plant rooms. With a couple of hours to go before company was expected, I would have liked to take a trip up to 52nd Street and help Ori paw through the cartons. But I had been instructed to stay put, and it was just as well. There were phone calls. One from Lon Cohen, one from our client in Omaha, and one from Pearly Stebbins, wanting to know if we had got a line on Johnny Keams's movements and contacts Wednesday evening. I told him no, and he was skeptical. When the doorbell rang a little after 5 o'clock, I expected to find Pearly on the stoop, come to do a little snarling. But it was a stranger, a tall, slim, narrow-shouldered young man looking very grim. When I opened the door, he was going to push right in, but I was wider and heavier than he was. He announced aggressively, "I want to see Archie Goodwin." "You are." "I are what?" "Seeing Archie Goodwin." "Who am I seeing?" "Oh, a wise guy." We were off to a bad start, but we got it straightened out that he meant that I was a wise guy, not that I was seeing one. And after I had been informed that his name was William Lesser, and he was a friend of Delia Brandt, I let him in and took him to the office. When I offered him a chair, he ignored it. "You saw Miss Brandt last night," he said, daring me to try to crawl out of it. "Right," I confessed. "About a piece about Malloy for some magazine." "Right." "I want to know what she told you about her and Malloy." I swiveled the chair at my desk and sat. "Not standing up," I told him. "It would take too long. And besides, I'd want..." "Did she mention me?" "Not that I remember." "I'd want some kind of a reason. You don't look like a city detective. Are you her brother or uncle or lawyer or what?" He had his fists on his hips. "If I was her brother, my name wouldn't be Lesser, would it? I'm a friend of hers. I'm going to marry her." I raised the brows. "Then you're off on the wrong foot, brother.
A happy marriage must be based on mutual trust and understanding, so they say. Don't ask me what she told me about her and Malloy. Ask her.
I don't have to ask her. She told me.
I see. If that's how it is, you'd better sit down. When are you going to be married? The chair I had offered was right beside him. He looked at the seat of it as if he suspected tax, looked back at me, and sat.
Listen, he said, it's not the way you make it sound. I told her I was coming to see you. It's not that I don't trust her, it's having it come out in a magazine. Haven't I got a right to find out what's going to be printed about my wife and the man she used to work for?
You certainly have, but she's not your wife yet.
When is the wedding?
Right away. We got the license today. Next week.
Congratulations, you're a lucky man, Mr. Lesser.
How long have you known her?
About a year, a little over.
Now, are you going to tell me what I asked?
I have no objection.
I crossed my legs and leaned back. This may ease your mind a little, the fact that the magazine wouldn't dream of printing anything Miss Brandt disapproved of or anything her husband disapproved of. Invasion of privacy. And you've given me an idea. The article would be a lot better with some real love interest. You know what the slant is, the last 10 months of a murder victim, as seen by his secretary. Well, all the time she is working for him and letting him take her out to dinner because she feels sorry for him, her heart is already in bond to another. She is deeply in love with a young man she intends to marry. That would make it a masterpiece. The contrast between the tragedy of the man who is going to die but doesn't know it, and the blush and promise of young love. Huh?
I guess so. What did she tell you?
Don't worry about that. I waved it away.
When it's written, you and she can change anything you don't like or take it out.
When were you engaged?
Well, it was understood quite a while ago.
Before the murder?
Formally engaged, no.
Does that matter?
Maybe not. While she's being sorry for Malloy, she can either be promised to another, or just hoping she soon will be. It would be swell if we could work in some reference, a sort of minor key to the murderer. We could call him that, since he's been convicted.
Only I don't suppose you knew Peter Hayes.
No.
Did you know about him?
Did you know he was in love with Mrs. Malloy?
No, I never heard of him until he was arrested.
It doesn't really matter. I thought perhaps Miss Brandt had mentioned him to you.
Of course, Malloy told her about him.
How do you know he did? Did she say so?
I don't remember.
I considered.
I'd have to look at my notes, and they're not here.
Did she tell you about Malloy asking her to go to South America with him?
No, she didn't.
Lesser was looking aggressive again.
I didn't come to tell you what she told me. I came to ask you what she told you.
I know you did. I was sympathetic.
But you have my word that nothing will be printed that you don't like, and that's what you were concerned about.
I can't tell you about my talk with Miss Brandt because I was working for a client and my report of that talk is his property. But I think...
Then you're not going to tell me.
I'd like to, but I can't.
But I think...
He got up and walked out.
From the back he looked even thinner than from the front.
I went to the hall to be polite, but he already had his coat off the rack and was reaching for the doorknob. He banged the door shut behind him, and I returned to the office. The wall clock said 5:25. Delia Brandt might have got home from work, or since she had gone with Lesser to get their marriage license, she might have taken the day off. I got at the phone and dialed the number of her apartment. No answer. I thought him over. There was one nice thing about him. He had had the makings of a motive, which was more than I could say for anyone else on the list. And he might easily have known enough about Peter Hayes to get the idea of framing him for it. But how could he have arranged for Fanny Irwin to have a headache and stay home, and for Rita Arkoff to invite Selma Malloy to use the ticket?
Even if that wasn't essential, if he was merely waiting for an opportunity to knock, how did he know it was knocking? How did he know Mrs. Molloy was away from the apartment and would stay away? It was worth looking for answers to those questions, because there was another nice thing about him. A wife cannot be summoned to testify against her husband. I dialed Delia Brandt's number again and got her. "I've just heard a piece of news," I told her, "that you're going to be married. I'm calling to wish you luck and happiness and everything that goes with it."
"Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. Is Bill there with you?"
"No, he left a few minutes ago. A fine young man. It was a pleasure to meet him. Apparently he was a little worried about the magazine article, but I promised him he would have a chance to veto anything he didn't like."
"So you knew he was coming to see me?"
"Oh, sure. He said he wanted to, and I thought since he was going to be my husband, it was only natural."
"Did you tell him everything? What did you tell him?"
It didn't look like paradise to me, him wanting to know what she had told me, and her wanting to know what I had told him, and they weren't even married yet. "Nothing much," I assured her. "Really nothing. After the promise I gave him, it wasn't necessary. Oh, by the way, now that I have you on the phone, I missed one bet entirely last night. At the end of the article, a sort of climax, you ought to tell where you were and what you were doing the evening of January 3rd. At the very minute Molloy was murdered, just after 9 o'clock, if you remember. Do you?"
"Certainly I do. I was with Bill. We were dining and dancing at the Dixie Bower. We didn't leave until after midnight."
"That's wonderful. That will fit right in with an idea I had and told Bill about. How all the time you were trying to be nice to Molloy because you were sorry for him, you were deeply in love with a young man who..." She cut me off. "Oh, the bell's ringing. It must be Bill." A little click and she was gone. It didn't matter much, since there was soon an interruption at my end. I had just hung up when the sound came of Wolf's elevator descending. And he had just entered and was crossing to his desk when the doorbell rang and I had to go to the hall to receive the company. I have already told about that, about Rita Arkoff ordering her mate to hang up his hat, and about Tom Irwin moving his chair next to his wife's and holding her hand. But looking back, I see that I haven't mentioned Selma Molloy. I could go back and insert her, but I don't care to cover up. I am not responsible for my subconscious, and if it arranged, without my knowing it, to leave Selma out because it didn't want you to know how it felt about her, that's its lookout. I now put her back in. Around 5 o'clock, she had returned from her errand at Parker's office, and at Wolf's suggestion, had gone up to the plant rooms to look at the orchids. He had brought her down with him, and she was sitting in the red leather chair after greeting her friends. Try again, subconscious.